Welcome to the Food Junkies Podcast. Here, we aim to provide you with the experience, strength, and hope of professionals actively working on the front lines in the field of food addiction. The purpose of our show is to educate you, the listener, and increase overall awareness about food addiction as a disease with abstinence as the solution. Here, we talk about all things recovery. Most importantly, how to thrive rather than just survive. So stay positive, make a change for yourself, tell others about your change, and hopefully the message will spread.
Hey there, Food Junkies listeners, Molly here. I'm so excited to share this episode with you. Jen, Heidi, and I discussed some important work being done to get an official diagnosis recognized by the World Health Organization and the American Psychiatric Association. The three of us, along with Clarissa, have been on a mission that started back in 2020, and we aren't giving up yet. There's still work to be done, and we're here for it. Be sure to check the show notes for the links and details about the International Food Addiction Consensus Conference. Please be aware that all ticket sales will end on May 12, 2024. This includes live stream, so be sure to buy now. P.S. Live stream tickets will come with replay. In this episode, you're going to hear all about how we got here, what the consensus process consists of, what we are most excited about, how the consensus work ties into the food addiction recovery clinical study we did, our next steps, and of course, the International Food Addiction Consensus Conference being held May 17th, 2024 in London, UK. All right, here we go. Welcome, Jen and Heidi.
Thank you so much for being here with me today, Jen and Heidi. And so, you know, I think the thing that I really wanted to start with this conversation is, you know, how did we even get to this point? Like, what even made you want to take on this consensus project? Like, what's the backstory? How did you design the process? Like, what were your best hopes? Can you just kind of flesh that out for us?
You start with that, Heidi, because it really was you who had the idea to get it going.
Yeah, I thought Molly was going to ask us to talk about how crazy are you really? Okay, so I suppose, you know, back in 2021, in March 21, we submitted to the WHO, to their ICD-11 committee, trying to get them to recognize food addiction. We didn't actually call it food addiction. We called it harmful use of foods because we knew that they didn't like the term addiction. And they took a bit of time to consider our proposal and they rejected it. And one of the grounds that they rejected it on was that they felt that there wasn't consensus amongst the experts. They felt that there was quite a lot of polarized opinion and that it could potentially cause confusion. And they had various objections. But this issue about that there wasn't consensus, we felt was actually probably not correct, that there is so much research now. I mean, we submitted, I think it was 182 publications in the end, something like that, scientific publications. So there is so much evidence, both clinically and the research. And so we thought, well, if that's their objection, let's deal with that very pragmatically and see whether we can get consensus. And that was it, really. And the rest is history. And then, so we started, well, then maybe I should let you talk a bit. But then we started thinking, how do we do this? So over to you, Jen.
Well, I was actually going to even go back in time and say, why did we even make that first submission to the WHO? And that was, again, you know, really Heidi was the driving force. She took over that job from Bitten Johnson, who sort of had it as part of her brief from the Food Addiction Institute. But she was so busy and you know, didn't want to really take it forward. So Heidi and I trained together with Bitten around that time. And I think Heidi just loves a big project, really. Is that true? I think you just love a big project. Why don't we do this thing?
I just
follow on behind. And I think our thinking there was, and always has been really, is that unless we can get the condition formally recognized as a condition warranting, you know, investigation and research and evidence-based treatments and interventions, the whole field is not going to progress. And of course, that's very problematic for all the millions of us that suffer with these symptoms and the increasing numbers of people who are suffering with these symptoms. So if it was recognized by the WHO or in America by the American Psychiatric Association, and then there are another group of people who are doing that work that we're hoping to coordinate with, there won't be research funded. And that, you know, in the world, that's research, big research projects don't get done unless, you know, there's research funding, and there won't be research funding unless there's an agreement that this thing is actually a real disorder that warrants investigation. And also up to now, there's been really very little research on outcomes for people with food addiction for that same reason. And so that's the big hurdle, really, is getting help to people who need it, and rather urgently.
So how did you even design, like, how did you come up with, right? Because, okay, we submit to the World Health Organization, they give us like their list of reasons why they're rejecting our application. And one of those being this consensus, and there's this lack of consensus according to them. So how did you design the process in which you worked to find consensus? Like, where did that come from?
Really good question.
Oh, we did. We sort of went down a few blind alleys with that, didn't we? Sort of trying to find somebody who could essentially help us with that. And then finally, we came across Professor Kossoff, and Heidi will tell you a little bit more about what he did and what he told us.
Yeah, so, and that was a bit difficult in the beginning. You're right, Jen. I'd forgotten that bit, actually. But of course, we actually got some help from a good friend, Nina Teicholz, who introduced us to Dr. Eric Kossoff at Johns Hopkins. And he is the person who is credited with having built consensus around the treatment of epilepsy with ketogenic diets. And so when I was having a conversation with Nina about what we were trying to achieve, she said, look, that this is the person you need to speak to. So Jen and I had a very nice meeting with him, where he then explained to us how he had run this process, consensus building process, following something called the Delphi model. And that's what we did. Yeah. And now we're at a very exciting stage where we've done that. So we started in May last year. And thanks to so many others, I mean, this is by no means just myself and Jen. This is, of course, you, Molly, as well, and Clarissa, who have been working so closely with us. And then all these amazing people that have said yes to take part. Can I say a bit more about that? Can we say that? Can we say?
Absolutely, please.
Yeah. So we set out, I think, now I might have this wrong, but I think Eric Kossoff had 26 participants in his original consensus 13, 14 years ago. So we set out, I hope he's good, if he listens, I hope he'll forgive us for that. But we set out to beat that and said we needed to get 30. And
guidelines, I think in the I'm not an expert on the Delphi method, but from what I've read, they say around 30 participants is usually the number that you can try and get a decent consensus from.
Yeah. So anyway, needless to say, I'm not going to steal the thunder of what we are about to present at our conference next month. But we did achieve that and bettered it, actually.
Which is so, so exciting. It's been an exciting adventure to just, like, you know, get the emails like so-and-so is on board, and so this person's on board, and oh, we're at this percentage. And that's been really fun. You know, I think it would be really important though for us to talk a bit about, like, what were we actually seeking consensus on? What were some of those points that the World Health Organization said, hey, these, we just don't agree?
I mean, I think one of the main ones, and that everybody would say, and you see it loads on social media, is what we should call it, because people all call it different things. So we've got sugar addiction, we've got carb addiction, we've got food addiction, we've got processed food addiction, ultra processed food addiction, and probably some other things as well. So I think one thing that everybody thought was, we need to coalesce as a group of clinicians and researchers around some nomenclature, if you like, so that that becomes a little bit more consistent. I mean, I think, you know, even when we reveal the consensus, I think, you know, that will carry on to a certain extent. But I think it's quite powerful that, you know, we have been able to get agreement, broad agreement for what to call it. So that's a good start.
Mm. So we basically structured the program around a set of workshops with small groups to make sure that everybody had a chance to participate, and then worked around five questions, one of which, as Jen says, was, what is this disease called? And then we also, it was very important to us as well, because of the one of the points that was presented to us by the WHO's ICD-11 committee was, is there sufficient evidence for this? So we also wanted to have that discussion. Is there sufficient evidence? and what is it, and where are there gaps in the research? Where do we need more research? Because that's another part of, as Jen was saying earlier, you know, this is part of a process. This isn't the end of the road for us. This consensus is to get us to the next, to a platform from which we can launch further work that has to be done in this area. We don't know it all yet. We just know we need to get together and agree what we can agree on, so that we can get further to the point where we're able to offer solutions to sufferers. That's basically the bottom line, isn't it?
Yeah, that's basically the aim. And it's, as Heidi says, you know, there'll be, it's really part of a process. And also when we all meet in May the 17th, a lot of the experts that took part will come to the event. So we're taking that opportunity, you know, to really get them minds together on, you know, what are the next steps now that we've got this sort of group of amazing, influential people together with the skills, you know, what sort of research, what might, if we wanted to try and get the funding for some research, what would be the next best, really good studies? That's what we'll be doing next year.
Next steps. Let's just get through May. Let's just get through the conference first, right? And then take a few weeks off and then jump back in. So speaking of the workshops, you know, I guess I just really am curious to know, and certainly I was part of the process, so I guess it's not so much my curiosity, but I'm acting as if I'm a listener here. And I'm wondering, you know, how did you structure those workshops? Were those also, like, was that laid out in the Delphi method? And how did you choose who would participate in those workshops?
So the question, I mean, you can use the Delphi method for getting consensus on any sort of, on any issue really, but you just have to ask a few questions, as Heidi was saying. So we had five or six questions, some which came from what the WHO had said in their rejection. And I mean, really what you do is just try and contact the key people internationally. So we just was all your contacts, our contacts, and then you can also go from there. So you ask those people, well, you know, who would you say might, you know, make a good contribution to this? So are they an outstanding researcher in the field? Are they an outstanding clinician or, you know, known for working in the field or something? You know, sometimes people are a bit of both. So it was that. And then they would refer us to other people and we just kept going and we were trying to be as international as we could, but obviously a lot of the our people that took part are from North America. We've got a few Europeans and one or two other people, but most of what's going on is actually going over on nearer to you than to us.
Yeah. Well, surprisingly, of course, we're writing up our results as we speak now. Surprisingly, we actually got 10 countries represented at least, which is, so I think we're quite proud of that. And I think the other thing that we tried to do, didn't we, Jen, was to make sure that we had a bit of diversity in terms of the different fields that were represented. So we've got neuroscience, we have addiction counselors, we have pediatricians, we have endocrinologists, we have dietitians.
Psychiatrists,
absolutely, yeah. So we wanted to also to try and, yeah, be diverse enough to be able to look at this challenge of that we see as that we call food addiction. We wanted to be able to see it represented in different perspectives. So that's been a really interesting, exciting part of the process. And actually, if you look at our lineup for the conference, we actually represent a lot of those different perspectives and fields in that conference with our speakers program, our very exciting speakers program.
We've even got an investigative journalist.
We do indeed.
Yeah, it's definitely been, I would say that part of the process was difficult because I wanted to like find contacts in like a variety of countries, a variety of professions, whatever. And, you know, and I guess I started looking at the research papers and I would find names and I would try to like hunt down, like, do they have a contact? Like, who are they? What do we, you know, to try to check off all of these boxes. And it does, it did get pretty difficult because as you said, like there's some key areas where the research is really coming from. So it's pretty easy to find, you know, some names, but then, yeah, it was definitely like, okay, who would you recommend or who do you think, you know, might be a good person to contribute to this? And that was definitely helpful. But yes, I mean, I just don't even know, Heidi, this is where I feel like you're like this magnificent project manager, because I'm like thinking of like this Rubik's, you know, or rubric, I guess is what it's called, where it's like, do they check, like, are they from a different country? Like, what profession are they in? Like, is it food addiction? Is it sugar? Like, how are they phrasing it in their literature? And to try to like span the variety of options that are out there when it comes to, you know, who we would consider maybe experts in this field. Yeah. I don't know how you kept it like all in the air. Like, how did you do that? How did you do you have a personal assistant? Do you have like a checklist? Alarms going off at all hours of the day?
You know, we have such an amazing, amazing support organization behind us, don't we? I mean, we have, especially helping us with the now with preparing for the conference, but we must also add that Fiona Griffiths has been an amazing support, sort of from an admin, keeping us sane, not letting us, or me in particular, not letting me drop any balls. So no, very good point, Molly, I think. I think the other thing that's maybe worth noting in terms of how we chose people, and of course you and Clarissa did an incredible job of that, of sifting through, finding, you know, also looking for different universities and so on. One challenge we did have, that you've now reminded me, is that we had groups of people wanting to join from the same faculty. And we didn't allow that because we felt that would then, we'd sort of be too, maybe there'd be a bit of bias or a bit too much of a heavy weight from the same organization or same faculty or same research group. I think we've been pretty good at keeping that diversity and representation.
That was definitely a challenge because you want it, right? Like there was part of us who was like, okay, we're trying to beat this 30 number and these are people that are willing to do it. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, yes. It's that balancing act of, okay, can there be one person who represents, and then do you recommend or can you refer us to anybody else? So what was or has been, I mean, it's not over. I mean, the consensus part of it, the first leg of it is over, but obviously we still have lots of work to do. And I'm just wondering, like, so far, what has been kind of like the most memorable experience from this process for you? Like, what has been like a big takeaway in doing this work? Because I don't think any of us have done anything like this before.
I think from my side, I am extremely humbled by the willingness, the determination, the helpful contributions by all these, you know, internationally known professional academics, clinicians, researchers. That has been mind-blowing for me. You know, they've all done this in entirely their own time, sometimes difficult times. They've joined us on, you know, hour-long workshops, two-hour-long workshops. So that has been, I'm sure there'll be so many other things. We're still in the midst of it, aren't we, Molly and Jen? Still trying to, you know, finalize what the statement's going to look like or get everything ready for the conference. But I think for me, that's it. It's been amazing that they have been so supportive and so determined to make this work. Because the bottom line is, if they hadn't been, we wouldn't be celebrating a consensus. It's down to them, actually.
They were willing and trying, you know, as much as they could. You know, some people did put some things aside for the sake of the consensus, didn't they? They, you know, they understood the importance of the project and were very generous about that. I think for me that it was just the most ridiculous privilege to sit through those workshops because I was kind of note-taking while you guys were steering the thing. And just to listen to those experts in the field really talking about their work. And it's just so exciting to hear what's going on and listen to some incredibly clever and dedicated people talk about their work. So that was a massive privilege. And that's my continuing professional development done for this year.
Hey, Food Junkies listeners. We're just going to take a quick break here to share with you something our team thinks could help benefit your recovery with food, body, or self. Thank you again for listening.
Hey there, Food Junkies listeners. You're invited to the International Food Addiction Consensus Conference being held on Friday, May 17th, 2024 in London, UK. This informative and engaging gathering will build awareness for the growing problem of food addiction, not only for us adults, but also for children and future generations. Speakers include Chris Van Tulliken, Robert Lustig, Michael Moss, Vera Tarman, Adrian Sotomoda, Erica LaFada, David Wiss, Timothy Brewerton, Anna Lemke, Nicola Vina, and Susan Pierce Thompson. But why should you attend? Because you can gain valuable insights from international researchers, physicians, clinicians, and metabolic experts. You can network with professionals and like-minded individuals and learn about food addiction and how ultra-processed foods impact the brain.
You can see the latest scientific research on the addictive nature of certain foods and the clinical research in this area. Finally, you can support our international program to get food addiction recognized as a disorder listed in the ICD-11 so we can improve the food environment for future generations. We hope you'll join us for a full day of education, connection, and hope. Be sure to check the show notes for the link to purchase your in-person or live stream tickets. If you're unable to attend or view the live stream and still want to support this work, you can donate a ticket by paying for another attendee, and we'll make sure it goes to a healthcare professional, student, or member of the public who wouldn't otherwise be able to attend. Just use the link in the show notes. You can spread the word. Share our cause with your friends, family, and colleagues. The more people who know about our mission, the greater our reach becomes. You can use social media, email, or good old-fashioned word of mouth to help us raise awareness. Finally, you can donate. Every dollar, pound, or any other currency you contribute goes directly towards making this conference possible and supports the work we're doing to get food addiction recognized by the World Health Organization. Again, please be sure to check the show notes for the link. All right, back to the episode.
Now back to the show. If you have enjoyed this episode, please let us know. We love to hear from you. Kindly leave us a review on whatever platform you listen to our podcast on. We love getting feedback from our listeners.
I would have to agree. It was, I mean, as a clinician, right? It was really, like you said, a ridiculous privilege to be able to sit there and hear these experts speak about the research they're doing currently or have done and their findings and like their experience in clinic or in research, you know, in their studies, and then to be able to take that and apply it along the way with like everything that we do working with clients, getting different guests for the podcast, you know, however, like it's just been this huge ripple effect. So I feel like this consensus stuff has gone, like the work, the project in and of itself is so much bigger than just finding consensus and just getting this into the ICD or even into the DSM. It's also this like networking and, you know, and that's one of the lovely things I think about Zoom these days, right? Is like, we would have had to get people to come to a conference to even have these conversations. And yet we were able to find, right? You were saying people like put stuff aside, or they would say like, hey, for the sake of consensus, I can let some of this go and we can talk about it later on down the line, you know, whatever. We were able to do that because of the technology that we have today. And I'm just so appreciative that you guys trusted me to come along on the ride with you and try to help out with this. I definitely feel like I've gained so much from this. I'm just really excited for others to gain from it by coming. And if they can't be there even to like live stream it and watch replay, if you know, they're in the US or some time zone that doesn't really work for it, because you're right. A lot of our speakers, in fact, I think every one of our speakers, right, was part of the consensus in some way. Yeah.
Except for Chris Santolikan. He joined us to introduce the conference.
Yeah. But I imagine he would join along with us if, you know, if we had had time.
I think he would sign his name. I think so.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's the other thing.
Just the bringing together of these people and connecting. Some of them obviously won't have been connected previously because they're either in the research camp or they're in the, you know, the clinician camp or whatever it is. You don't always. So I think going forwards, the fact that we've been able to connect people and a lot of them will come to London and make that personal connection, I think will really help the work going forwards and will help the fields going forwards because of those new alliances.
I think you're very right, Jen, on that. And I think what's also what we're seeing is beginning to happen now as we prepare for the conference is that some of these experts are now are beginning to introduce their own colleagues. So it's going to we're going to get a snowball effect from it. So which I think is extremely exciting. There are people like hopefully Chris Ventalican, but also other people that we've had now contact us saying, can I support this? Other experts in their field. So I don't think we'll end up with just this group signing the consensus. I think there's going to be a lot more.
Yeah, and people who just couldn't take part for whatever reason.
Exactly.
I'm sure we'll sign up to it and support the WHO submission when that comes next time. Yes.
Next job.
Yeah, for sure. So I'm curious to know, again, I'm not actually curious to know, but I'm pretending to be a listener here. How does this consensus work tie back to our food addiction recovery clinical study stuff that we started also back in 2021 or 2020? I don't even remember now how long ago it's been. When did we do that? Because we're still collecting data, obviously. The initial intervention was over, you know, a year ago, 2 years ago at this point, maybe. So can you kind of talk to like how what we're doing with the consensus stuff ties into that research that we did, that study that we did?
So I think what we knew was, as I kind of said at the beginning, was that there's no research on outcomes for people going through a food addiction program. And Heidi and I were wanting to run a food addiction program, and a little bit like, so I've done a lot of work with my husband, who's a GP, Dr. David Unwin, and he started helping people with type 2 diabetes to reverse that drug-free by getting them to change their nutrition basically to a sort of low carbohydrate diet. And when we started, that was a little bit controversial. So we thought, right, we need to gather lots of data. And then that data has been really impactful because the people weren't doing that at the time. And now he's probably got the most and the biggest data set internationally on that topic. So it just sort of made sense that if we were going to run a program, we would do a clinical audit. Essentially, we would look at the outcomes for those people because there was nothing else. Then it occurred to us, you guys were running similar programs, basically a sort of real food, real whole food as nature intended, as Heidi says, approach with psychoeducation around the brain and the way that food, certain foods affect the brain. And then, you know, how do you kind of implement this in real life? And so that sort of psychoeducational piece, so the sort of dietary advice, but also the psychoeducational stuff, putting those two things together. We knew you guys were doing that. And we also knew that the guys in Sweden, Lever Sockerfri, that I'm probably pronouncing horribly, we're doing the same. So we thought, well, why don't we see if you guys want to do the same? You know, we'll sort of set it up so that everybody's running their programs online. Everybody's going to get the same data before, after 6 months and 12 months. And that data will be gold dust because nobody else is doing that at the minute. We knew we could kind of do that without, in a sense, without any resource, any financial resources, because we were just really auditing what we were going to be doing anyway, which is sort of the same model that David and I had employed. So we've published the pre and post intervention paper. So I'm sure we can add the link to that. And we were really pleased with the, you know, people significantly improving their symptoms, both on the Yale Food Addiction Scale and the CRAVE scale, which we developed from the WHO criteria for addiction. Also mental well-being improving significantly. And weight, although we weren't terribly interested in weight, weight are going down statistically significant amount. And we're just now analysing the 1 year post data, some of which you'll get a glimpse of at the conference as a little teaser to when we write up the paper. But yeah, it's been, I think, a really important thing to have done, because it essentially proves that, you know, there's hope and that you can help people with a relatively simple program. It's not really rocket science, what any of us did. Well, perhaps we should say it was rocket science. No, it's just really combining those two approaches and supporting people, you know, through their recovery makes such a huge difference to people's lives. I mean, obviously not everybody, it's like any intervention, isn't it? Not every single person benefits, but, you know, the vast majority of people have had a really clinically benefit. And that's been, again, it's been another privilege. And we've learned as we've gone along, haven't we? And we've learned from each other. And it's been really nice how well that what we've done has been received as well. So that's a little summary of it.
Heidi, did you want to add to that as far as like how that clinical study kind of ties into the conference and the consensus work?
So it ties in in a couple of ways. One being that, as Jen has said a couple of times, that it is research that is quite unique. You know, there isn't any research out there on outcomes of recovery programs like ours, this biopsychosocial model that we put together. And we also had significant numbers in this. So, you know, there might be small studies and that's not to say that there isn't lots of work going on. And of course, our tutors themselves have done lots of work in this area, but it's not actually been done as a proper formal study with data being collected. And of course, that's what's so important, that we need to be able to show the data to demonstrate that this actually does work. And that's what we're doing. And so, yes, it adds value there and hopefully adds inspiration when we talk about, you know, next step following this consensus, inspiration for others to do similar work so that we get more data and we get more experience of maybe even get to a point where we're comparing different types of recovery models or treatment programs. So I think that's probably the big way in which it ties in. And of course, in specifically related to the conference, we are going to show a little bit an insight into the results, but a paper will follow after the conference.
Well, I was just going to slip in that I'm quite excited because I hope it's all right to, I'm not going to give anything away, Heidi, but
I knew you were going to do this.
Give anything away. The YFAS obviously is an amazing tool and has been used all over the place in research. I mean, it really is the one. There's hundreds of papers using the YFAS, looking at prevalence and also outcomes. And it was kind of designed as a research measure. But I think anyone who's tried to use it for those purposes would probably agree it's not very easy to score. And in fact, all of us, we really had to concentrate and kind of work out spreadsheets and things like how do you score this thing? So we knew that nobody in clinic is going to have the time to do that. It wasn't designed for that. It's not a criticism of the YFAS for what it was designed for, but it's not very useful as a screening tool in a clinic. So that was why we developed the tool CRAVE, which is only 6 questions. So the other thing that's going to be presented at the conference is kind of comparing the two, how they performed and how useful or not a CRAVE might be in a clinic setting. So we're excited about that as well, because I think if people have a simple screening tool like there are for other addictions like alcohol, or there are some really nice simple tools for just screening for eating disorders, for example, then it's more likely that clinicians are going to think about including those questions, or, you know, think about screening for food addiction in their clinics, which they really need to do. Because as David's a doctor in primary care, and he says now he knows about it and he knows how to ask the questions, he sees it in every single clinic. And there are people all over the world who are not getting the right advice and help because nobody's recognizing the problem for what it is. They think it might be an eating disorder when it isn't, or they think it might be a mental health problem when it isn't. So I think that's very important going forward.
Yeah. And I think since you've given that little nugget about what we will present at the conference there, that also ties in a bit with the consensus, doesn't it? Because actually what you say there, being able to distinguish between food addiction and an eating disorder is so, so, so vital to being able to give the right treatment. Knowing now what we do, that actually, basically, that we, if you treat a food addiction with all foods being equal, you're not going to actually solve the problem. So actually, you know, there is no solution with an eating disorder treatment for a food addict. Doesn't actually solve the problem at all.
Is that maybe why, you know, we know that the outcomes in eating disorder services, you know, exactly, are thrilling? You know, this could be one kind of contributor. Got a couple of reels on the topic of food addiction, a topic of eating disorders and food addiction. So if anyone's interested in that, you're going to have Dr. David Wiss, who's amazing on this topic, and also Timothy Brewerton as well. So yeah, definitely buy the live stream or come along if you're anywhere near London.
The conference. Yeah, exactly. And as part of the consensus, of course, that was one of the questions. I don't know whether that's what you were alluding to, Molly, in your question. That was, of course, one of the issues that became a discussion point. Do you see food addiction and eating disorders together? Are they distinct, et cetera, et cetera? So it is a very important part of the whole discussion about what is food addiction.
That wasn't actually my point or intention, but if that was the impact, then I'm glad that we're having this discussion, because as you were sharing, that was my thought too, is, you know, when we put together these programs that we ran and they were all very similar, I mean, obviously they weren't exactly the same, but they were similar in like what it was, like how we were doing it, what we were talking about, what we were asking the participants to do, you know, I just keep thinking, I've seen the data, and if this wasn't real, then why are we having the results that we're having with, like you said, it wasn't rocket science. We took what we knew to be true from other substances of abuse, other behaviors of, you know, process addiction, and we just tailored it to food and we did some intervention, and it's amazing what's happening, even with the 12-month data, right? Like we've seen studies where there's 3-month data, there's 6-month data, but we've got a year out, you know, and it's exciting.
To have a year follow-up. I was just looking at a study this morning that has like three. I mean, it's a bit like we were really that sort of pre and post point. And then often you never see any more data. And oftentimes that's because actually what happens is that people slip back or the data aren't so good. So it just doesn't get published. There's that publication bias, isn't there, that only positive stuff gets published. So yeah, we're incredibly proud of ourselves to have 1 year data.
And for it to still be a significant number of people, right? That was another time where we had to have so many participants because we knew the dropout rate would be, you know, that there would be this, you know, predicted dropout rate. And we needed so many, right, to have statistical significance to like actually show that what we did was still helping in the long run. And
actually, we've got a really decent number of people staying in and filling out those questionnaires. I mean, I haven't sort of that yet, but I suspect that's better than the normal dropout that you would get at a year. Actually, I think people have stuck it.
Yeah. Which I think just speaks to what you rate, like what we're doing. It was helpful. Yeah. It was helpful. Exactly. They wanted to keep showing up. They wanted to keep
helpful. They'd go and do something else.
They'd be gone. Yeah, definitely.
And also the fact that our outcomes are significantly better than outcomes for traditional eating disorder treatments. I mean, that's also quite astounding, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It is. So what then are the next steps? We've talked a lot about like how we got here, and we've said like there's more to come, like there's still more work to do. And again, I'm not wishing that on any of us anytime soon. We definitely need to take a little break before we launch into that. But what then would be the next step? So there's going to be a workshop at the conference for consensus participants. And I say that it's at the conference, but it's not really. It's the day before, we will gather. Yeah. Yep, we will gather the day before. In that, what is the best hopes with that workshop?
So the best hopes, Jen, I'll give you mine. I think I speak for all of us. Our best hopes are that we end up with two projects that come out of it. One that looks at our next submission to the ICD-11 committee in the WHO, and which we hope to coordinate with the team of Ashley Gearhart and Erica Lafata and co, who are working on the DSM by representations to the APA. Then we hope that the other group will look at what research needs to be done going forward. So that's basically both of them are direct outcomes of the consensus, but looking at what the conclusions have been about the necessary research or useful research. And then we want to be supporting fundraising for that research. What do you think?
Yeah, because it's hard to apply for grants for a condition.
Absolutely.
Why don't we, like we have for the conference, really? I mean, people have been incredibly generous. We did a fundraising so that we could fly people over, you know, so we could have this really nice venue in central London that should be accessible as possible to all our international guests and everybody else. Yeah, we've had some really big, generous donations to that. And so we think, well, you know, there's enough people in this community who want to see that research happen, that if we decide what's the next best study or studies to do, and now we're in contact with all those fantastic researchers, you know, maybe we can get a group of those researchers together to collaborate, and they can tell us what resources they need, and then we can go ahead and try and find those resources for them.
Keep
moving the whole field forward.
And we do appreciate that. I mean, we do need donations. We do all this for free, of course. We're all volunteers, but the research does cost money. So we appreciate anybody who's prepared to donate a little bit or a lot. And we'll keep our Just Giving page going, won't we?
We can give you that link for the show notes. If anybody does want to donate, if you can't come, then please
do. Yeah.
We'll go to this project. So I wouldn't be used for anything else.
It doesn't pay any salaries or admin or anything like that. We do all that between us. And then we should also say, shouldn't we, that our speakers have been extremely generous as well, donating their time also for the speaking appointments, for which they would normally charge a fee. And the vast majority of them are not doing so, which is very good.
Definitely. So I guess in conclusion, I just really want to let people know why they should come. And if they can't be there in person, which we would love to have you in person, like, I'm a big fan of like, please come in person. And when you see me, you'll know because my hair is now purple. I will probably be the only purple haired person there. Like, come say hi. Like, I want to meet you. Like, definitely there's that aspect. I want to network. I want to meet you. But why should people come? Why should they buy the live stream? Like, what will they get out of it?
I just think it's a really historic moment, actually. If you're listening and you're either a researcher or a clinician or just a member of the public who's interested, or you've got your own story, or a member of the family who's got their own story, I think it's a really historic day for the whole food addiction space. And you'll be able to say, I was there. Like Woodstock. So I think there's that. I mean, really, if you look on the Eventbrite page, the caliber of the speakers all in one place, those international speakers, you know, it is really mind-blowing to have all those people in one space. I mean, we did a conference a couple of years ago, but, you know, we didn't fly so many people over. You know, it was lovely, but it wasn't quite the sort of high-powered, hard-hitting folk that are coming this time. So that's the live stream. If you can come in person, you'll also be able to either bring your copy of your favorite food addiction book, or quite a few of the books will be on sale, and you can stick it under the nose if you're a Vera Tarman or Chris Van Tulleken and get them to sign it for you. Nicola Vida's going to be there, Susan Pierce Thompson, all these people have got, you know, big followings and big loyal sort of
Robert Lustig. You have Robert to Lustig. Mention Lustig. Come on.
Timothy Bruton, we've mentioned, David Wyss.
Yeah. Michael Moss. A lot of Michael people will Moss, know Michael Moss.
Who wrote I mean, he's
incredible book.
You know, hats off to his
investigative journalism
escapades with the food industry. Yeah. So I'm really looking forward to hearing him, actually. So yeah. And Adrian Sotomota, that people may not have heard of, but he's got brain the size of a planet when it comes to data, and he's very interested now in this whole topic. He comes from Mexico City, and he recognizes that it's a major problem. It's a major, major problem for him as a doctor working in a hospital, and he's been gathering lots of data. So, yeah, it's...
I was going to say, he's got some exciting data to share, hasn't he? Yeah.
And the food's going to...
And then, I was just going to say, we now that we've mentioned all these
foods... Yeah, so I've been talking to the caterers over the last few days, sorting out some lovely whole real foods as nature intended, nothing processed.
I was just going to say, we mentioned so many of the speakers, we need to mention the rest as well. So we didn't mention Erica Lafata, who's done some amazing research as well that she's going to share with us. And of course, one of our other favorites, Anna Lemke, Dopamine Nation, an amazing book. She's going to be talking to us. And have we then covered everybody? I think so. But it's a lineup, 11, it's a lot in a day, but my goodness, I don't think you're going to go to many conferences and get that caliber, that number of that caliber of speakers compressed into a day and so available to you. It's unmissable. That's what we keep saying, an unmissable opportunity.
Yeah, I'm so excited because not just like the caliber of individuals who are coming to present and the number, but the topics that they're going to be talking about, you know, speaking about, where like the science, you know, the public policy, like conceptualizing food addiction, you know, whatever it is we're going to call it, as a substance use disorder, like why it has to go beyond like this idea of all foods fit for all people all the time or whatever, like why it has to go beyond moderation, like how it impacts our mental health. Like there are just so many amazing topics that are going to be presented. And like you said, you know, Anna Lemke with the dopamine, you know, we're also fascinated with dopamine. I feel like, you know, why not come and learn from the woman who wrote the book? Yeah. Yeah. Yes. And just like Nicola Vina and how she will talk about like those actual impacts of the food on the brain. You know, there's just so, and like Susan Pierce Thompson, who is so charismatic, you know, and really, 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 really wants to champion so much of what is happening right now, right in the field. So I just agree with you guys that you've done phenomenal work to get these folks across the pond, if you will, because I think most of them are traveling from the US with the exception of what, Chris Van Tulleken?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And Adrian's coming from Mexico.
Mexico.
So you've done phenomenal work. And as you've said, if you can't make it, if you can't buy the live stream, you know, whatever, consider donating, because every little bit helps to continue this kind of work, to continue the research, to continue networking, or even like creating or facilitating a, you know, an event like this so that those people can network. Yeah. And it just grows what we're doing all the way around on all the different levels. So I don't know any last. Yeah, go ahead, Jen.
I was just going to say, in terms of the live stream, obviously, if you're listening in Australia or New Zealand or even parts of the States, it's going to be a challenge to live stream. But if you buy a live stream ticket, and it's really cheap, I think it's £35, we will, as fast as we can, send you a recording of the day. So we just need to turn around the tech, and then we'll give people a link to that. So, you know, consider that as well. Even if you can't make it on the day, you could watch it over the next weekend or whenever we send it out.
Yeah. Yep. I was just going to do a quick conversion to like figure out what that would be, you know, for US dollars. It's like $44 US. It's not, again, for 11 speakers of that caliber for $44 for a recording that then you have, like, I don't know that you can go wrong.
And that money goes to the project. So all the live stream tickets in a way are money for the project, because we don't have to feed those people or give them a seat in the Royal College. So all of that money will go to the project if you buy a live stream ticket.
Any last burning thoughts that we should share?
Just a big welcome. Come and join us. We'd like to meet you as well.
Totally. Yeah. Thanks.
Thanks for joining us this week on Food Junkies, Recovery from Food Addiction. Make sure to join our Facebook group, Sugar Free for Life Support Group, I'm Sweet Enough. You can subscribe to our show in iTunes or Stitchers. That way you'll never miss an episode. While you're at it, if you found value in this show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Or if you'd simply tell a friend about the show, that would help us out too. Don't forget to pick up your copy of Dr. Tarman's book, Food Junkies, which is available on Amazon. If you have any additional questions, both Molly and Clarissa are food addiction professionals and work one-on-one with clients. You can find their websites and email addresses in the show notes. Be sure to tune in every Friday when our new episodes drop. As Vera loves to say, the power is ours.